So I just thought maybe, you know, since we talked quite a bit last night and this morning, if anybody has any questions, just at the get-go, because sometimes they might be answered, but it's also sometimes it's a good thing to just from the last session to get those out of the way if anybody has ones that are pressing. Yes. Oh, we got the microphone, sorry.
Check. Oh, I'm live. Last night you talked about you're a general contractor in your part-time world, and the thing that I struggle with a lot in my life is taking that I'm in business, right, marketing and all those things, and the day-to-day tends to flood into my prayer life, and I'm wondering, as a monastic, we always think that you're there at St. Tikhon's in some cave, and you don't see anything in the outside world, but yet here you are, of course, managing in a sense. I mean, you are like a manager there, unfortunately, probably, where you're dealing with all paying the bills and everything that you do, especially for, I'm sure, preparing for pilgrimage, and now you're building this beautiful building for icons and things like that. How do you separate that? Like, you go from, oh my gosh, the plumber's not here for this building, and now I have to turn my mind into liturgy and prayer. That's where I struggle with, of coming home and whatever that is in my life, of trying to turn that switch off. And here you are, an abbot, a monastic, a priest, where you're managing in the secular world, but all of a sudden now you're Father Sergius, the abbot, and now you need to pray. How do you turn your mind off that's not worried about the plumbing in the new icon building?
The general principle that is operative throughout all of this is orthodoxy, especially orthodox spirituality, is not either or. It's always both and. So a lot of times we have that thing, either I go to church or I'm working. Either I'm, you know, an orthodox Christian or I'm not. You know, either I'm secular or I'm spiritual. I think that those either-or distinctions are not helpful for spiritual life, and so we're both and. So I'm just a person of prayer, whether I'm doing the plumbing or whether I'm praying. But when I am doing the plumbing, I'm praying. You know what I mean? I'm not trying to divide myself into something that's kind of mildly artificial. So at least in theory, just let both of those areas come together and become unified so that there's no... You know, we have a dire kind of situation in our culture where we're just kind of Sunday-only Christians sometimes. We kind of compartmentalize church into one day and say, okay, God got his part, so now I can do all the other things I have to do, whether for myself or for other people. But that approach doesn't really help real spiritual life. Real spiritual life is bringing the actual church into all of my existence so that there's no compartmentalization. There's no wall of separation. There's nothing that divides up my day between what's God's and what's mine, because really all of it's God's. I was thinking about it on the way over here. You know, time is such a gift. You know, I remember that cartoon Family Circus? You know, so often, you know, those cartoons, they have a lot of truth in them. And I remember the little girl in Family Circus said, "Mommy, you know, today's a gift. That's why they call it the present." You know? And it's true. You know, and I remember I was at the doctor. I go to I have an Orthodox doctor up in Massachusetts, and they were talking to me about this. You know, I had this problem, and they said, "Well, you know, it's probably not going to be any serious things, but just so you know, there is this medicine, but it's very expensive, and, you know, and it would only, you know, you'd only get probably like a year or two or three, and it's like $250,000 for the year." And I was thinking to myself, you know, I didn't have anything serious, but looking at that kind of perspective where somebody would be paying $250,000 to pay to live for another year, it kind of gives you an idea just how valuable time really is. If somebody's willing, like let's say they have the money to pay for a medicine that is exorbitantly expensive to continue to be alive, it just shows that life is precious. It's priceless. But yet we have it right now. It's a free gift for us just for today. So understanding that kind of concept of just what a gift today is, and that it's God's gift to us, and that our life, you know, should be God's, our gift to God, you know, whatever that is. And that's ultimately found in prayer and service and you know, kind of keeping our life somehow focused or centered around the church. So my advice to you is just bring more of prayer into your other part of your life. And then when the problems do come up, ask God to help with those and bless them and to give you creative answers to your marketing dilemmas and to the accounting problems that you might have. I'm constantly asking St. Nicholas for money. So, I have to make payroll every month. And that's hard. It's not like some easy task. I have Josh and about 24 other people that are on my payroll. So, there's an ebb and flow to, the books, most of the money comes out of the bookstore, but it's not, I put money into the bookstore, so it's not like it's just a seamless kind of situation there. But St. Nicholas says, turn your cares into prayers. It's how to create so that there's not quite a wall of separation. So when I'm starting to worry when I'm praying about payroll, I'm talking to St. Nicholas. And St. Nicholas always has a way of figuring it out for me because I can't. But I think that's the better part of it is not compartmentalizing. No either or rather a both and approach, because I was thinking about, St. Paul says redeem the time, redeem the time because the days are evil. How do we redeem the time? What does that mean? And I was thinking, I know that it sounds very basic and almost kind of simplistic and maybe in an overly simplistic way, but, just saying the Jesus prayer is an easy way to redeem the time. You're sitting at a bus waiting for a ride. You're in the doctor's office. You're at the grocery store and you're waiting in line. You may think that it's like, oh, well, that's, again, why? But what could be more profound? What could be more essential? What could be more right than, Father Zacharias talks about how the day that God revealed his name to us is a special day, and it's a gift. That I know in my life that there was a time where I was raised Catholic, and then I just kind of went away from the church when I was in school, and then just around out of high school, I started going back to church, and there was a moment where not only did I kind of return to church, which was kind of no small miracle, there was like about 10 people, one of my half-brother, he was going to church, and they had a prayer group, and they put my name on it. So 10 people were praying for me, and then lo and behold, like maybe within 6 months to a year, I was back in church. Prayer is very powerful. When the church prays and a bunch of people pray for somebody who's sick or wayward or left the faith, or it's an incredibly profound opportunity to see the hand of God work. Because those prayers, we don't have to be great saints in order for God to hear us, especially if we do it together. That's what the church is. The church is salvation. So if all of us in this room decide that we're going to pray for, some kind of particular situation in the church or for a particular person maybe, because you can maybe see it a little bit more clearly with that, like maybe somebody who's sick or somebody who's having a hard time. This is my easiest way to do this. Like sometimes somebody in the monastery is really struggling, right? One of the novices or something like that, because it's really hard to be there. It's hard to explain, but it's tough. Right, Anthony? He was there. It's hard. It's hard to live a spiritual life all the time. It's overwhelming. The presence of God becomes more of a fire that consumes and burns rather than a thing that we kind of rejoice in and find consolation in. St. John Climacus says the super celestial fire at one and the same time illumines and burns. So it depends on our state. It can be caustic or it can be therapeutic. Well, not therapeutic, but kind of consolation. It could be a spirit of consolation or a spirit of kind of caustic kind of reproof. It's the same spirit of God. And what is God's wrath in the Old Testament? It's his love. People wrongly related to that love, they call it wrath. It's the presence of God that they weren't rightly related to. But being in the monastery, because it's a difficult how would I say it? There's no time to kind of take off, as it were. You know what I mean? So it constantly forces you into this position where you have to face God. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but for the rest of us who are kind of out and about, the most essential part for us is to remember the Lord. So when one of those novices, let's say they're struggling, I'll ask maybe 10 people to pray. Like I'll just text 10 of my priest friends, pray for, you know, so-and-so. And they'll say, okay, you know, they know what I'm asking for. I just want their prayers. And usually, like, within that day, by the end of the day, that person will be in a lot better place. Like 9 times out of 10. I have somebody, a priest that I know who's right by the relics of St. John Maximovich. So he'll go do him 11 real quick for me. It's incredibly powerful prayer, just us normal people praying. It really does work. And to see the hand of God in that is to know what the power of the church is and what the power of prayer is and what we can do together. It's when we're divided that there's a problem. But really, we should, in our own heart, like, we should never, like, divide ourselves from people. We should always be kind of trying to unite other people in our hearts, in our prayer, and offering them to God. So if you go to pray and you do your prayer roll, say the Jesus prayer for all the members of your family and ask them to bless their day, to bless their time, to help you guys to stay together and to be strong together. Always carry everybody that you know that's close to you in your own heart and constantly offer them to God. This is like the better part of the work of a parent. Elder Saint Porphyrius says, talk to God about your children and have God talk to your children. Don't talk to them directly a lot about stuff because it's just like, ah, ah, ah. But if it goes this way, then God's like, well, they're like, well, you know, they're a little bit more open, you know, because God's doing it and it's much more either subtle or profound. So, but the life of prayer is something that if we consistently do, that day then that Christ revealed his name to me, I remember. It was like, oh yeah, Jesus Christ is God. You know, that's a real thing. It's like there is a point in our lives where God calls us back to the church and then he reveals himself to us. It's like that's the great nature of like of who God is. God is not the God of like the textbooks and the quote theologians of the textbooks and the academics. He's the God of the heart. And he's a God who reveals himself. And this is the great message of the Old Testament and the New Testament. We sing it every time at Matins. The Lord is God and has revealed himself to us. Blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. We give thanks to the Lord for his good, for his mercy endures forever. Our God is a God of revelation. And even St. Paul talks about this in his epistle. He says, not by man and not by anybody else, but by revelation. Jesus Christ, you know, he speaks in these terms. It was the revelation of Christ to him, but it wasn't after man. It was literally after God. But that revelation, fortunately, it's not like, you know, somebody in the wilderness that's a, you know, cult leader or something. This is the same revelation given again and again that's confirmable and that's universal. So we have a revealed witness, which is confirmed by innumerable cloud of witness. And that's where kind of our safety lies. We enter into that same revelation, into that same dogmatic visionary consciousness, which is the church. And what does the church provide us? Why are icons so important in the Orthodox Church? What does the church give to us if not the vision of God? And first and foremost, that vision is kind of reiterated in so many facets of the church's life, in the architecture, in the music, but most especially in the iconography. The prototypical icon is an icon of Christ, the icon not made with hands. This is, of course, we just commemorated a few days ago, that first icon that of Christ where he, you know, there's two different stories about how it came to be. One was in the West, St. Veronica took the cloth and wiped the face of Jesus. He pressed it to his face on the road to Golgotha. And the other one in the east of how that cloth came to be was that Prince Abgar was very sick and he sent one of his emissaries to see Christ. And Christ took he was trying to get a picture of him. He couldn't do it. So he said, give me a cloth. And Christ pressed the cloth into his face and gave it to the man and said, take this to the king. And that actually became the first Christian nation in Edessa. That we know of. And that cloth was around till about the 9th, 10th, 11th century, something like that. And then we just don't know where it went after that, after the Crusades, I think in the 12th century, that fourth crusade. But nevertheless, that icon of Christ, to give, St. Paul says, the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. To give the light of the knowledge of the glory. Knowledge, light, and glory in the face. And that face is the epicenter of the person, and that person is God himself, the person of God. This is the epicenter of the Christian phenomenon, the person of Christ. And the church remembers the face. That face is the same in the 5th century. It's the same in the 4th century. It's the same in the 9th century. It's the same in the 12th century. It's the same today. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. The church remembers that face. The church knows that face. Why? Because the icon is a pledge and a beginning of the vision of God, which is salvation. When people see God, that's when that aspect or that part of the fall in them is healed. You see it in the gospel with like Zacchaeus, right? He saw Christ. He was up on the tree. He climbed up a tree. He kind of made a fool of himself. He humbled himself. And in that moment when he saw Christ, he was redeemed. And he went on to become, you know, kind of a great apostle of sorts. But iconography is so central. Why? Because it reminds us that the church is the faithful and true witness of the living vision of God. That's what imparts to us, and it's the same vision for all of us. It's not like you're going to see something different and you're going to see something different. It's the same thing all the way from Moses to Isaiah to St. Paul to St. Siloam to us today. The same God, it's the same vision. We enter into it, that is salvation. So iconography is not just by the way. It's not just about pretty pictures. It's about somehow this world entering into the incarnational vision of the church and being a revelatory point of the life and the mystery of God's salvation to the world in a concrete way. It reminds us not only of it's a confirmation of the incarnation, but it almost is like the continuing redemption of the entire material world into the church. So all of our life, the accounting, the marketing, all of that stuff needs to come into the church. There's no like either or us and them. All of creation, the fathers tell us, is called to enter into the church. The whole creation. Not just me and my body, but my entire world. So our job as the priesthood of believers is to offer the sacrifice of our lives on the heart, the altar of our heart, and to bring all of those things into the church and redeem them and make them part of the church, which is kind of what an icon does. An icon takes the world, takes all the different elements of the world, the minerals, the animal kingdom, the plant world, and indeed man's part as well as kind of the co-creator of it, and it redeems it. It enters into a relationship with God through the church, the material world, through us. This icon was painted on the Mount of Olives convent in Jerusalem. So all that stuff over there in Jerusalem was put in to this, you know, the paints and the egg tempera from those chickens over there. And, you know, they cut down a tree over there and they made a board out of it. And then the nun, she painted this icon. And she brought the material world through her own work into the church. And now it's a miracle working icon. But somebody had to do that. And that somebody is you and me. In our own way, in our own time, in our own place, whatever it might be. Oh, Jesus is calling. Is it God? Hello? Don't worry, it's all right. Yes. Oh, sure. Go ahead, speak into the microphone.
Okay, could you tell us some of the miracles that have occurred with this icon?
Sure. There's so many. A lot of them are people who couldn't have kids. They come. I remember one couple was down. There's so many of them, it's hard for me to remember them all, but I went to West Virginia one year, and there was a couple there. They hadn't been able to have a child ever. It had been 15 years that she was barren, and they just had become Orthodox maybe a couple years before that I got there. And so we brought the icon down, said some prayers for them, anointed them with oil, told them to go to confession and communion, continue to pray to Saints Joachim and Anna, do their Akathist as much as they could, or, prayers to them. And so about a year later, I got a card in the mail, maybe a little more because it was COVID, and they took a little bit extra time to write, but they said, we were completely barren. There was no hope for us, and now we have a baby. We just baptized this baby. Here's a picture. We want to thank you and thank St. Anna for this miracle. That happens all the time, all the time. Sometimes I remember, there's a good story in, I was somewhere last year in Michigan. And there was a woman that came up to me. She said, you were here 2 years ago, the same parish as my friend's parish. So I went back because he asked me, and so I did. But she said I was there, and I had been in chronic pain for like maybe 8 years with some kind of fibromyalgia kind of thing, chronic pain. And she said she went up before the icon, and this is a great kind of illustration of just like, spiritual life. She said, I went up in front of the icon. I was about ready to ask for her help to heal me. And then I remembered two of my friends that were in far worse shape than I was, and so I prayed for them instead. And then I went home, she says, and she woke up the next morning and the pain was completely gone. And it hadn't returned in all that time since, from that first time I came to the second time. She says, I just wanted to tell you about that miracle. But it was interesting because she didn't pray for herself. She was like, I could pray for myself, but you know what? There's these people that are so in so much more need. That's when God hears our prayer. God's like, I will help them. And in fact, since you were put yourself last, I will put you first now. And so her pain, which had been chronic for years, completely vanished. One of the greatest miracles, though, with this particular icon that I can recall that is always a stupefying thing in my mind. I don't know if you've heard this. You probably heard me tell this story before. But I was in California, and it was 2014, somewhere around there. And you know how California is. They're always having problems. But the drought there had been going on for like 8 years. And so the reservoirs were incredibly low. It's always kind of the same. They kind of go like this. So I had been in Colorado a year or two before, and there was a Romanian priest there, and he said, they were having a drought in Colorado as well a couple of years previous. And the priest said, we had a miracle-working icon of St. Anna in the village. And what we would do is when there was a drought, we would take the icon in procession like this, and then we would do the prayers for rain at each of the corners of the church. Everybody would kneel. Then you go back in the church. Everybody goes underneath the icon like on Holy Saturday, and then everybody kneels and does the final prayer in the church. The extra prayers are about an hour or so. So we did that in Colorado, and it rained a bit, and I didn't really think much more about it. But then when we got to California, I thought, well, let's do that, because I talked to the priest there. He was my friend in Fremont. It's kind of where I'm from. And he said, I think that'd be a great idea. So I wanted to kind of seal the deal. And I said, let me just call the bishop and get a blessing to end the drought, So I called Bishop Benjamin at the time, and I said, Vladika, I was like, could we have your blessing this morning to do the prayers to end the drought? And he said, whatever, you have my blessing, I called Metropolitan because he's my bishop. I said, I would like your blessing to end the drought in California. And he said, you're crazy, you have my blessing. And then so we did the prayers. We went, four corners, all these elaborate prayers. You go back in the church. We did all the things, kneeled. Everybody's kneeling. It's very profound. Sky was like this when I left on a Monday or Sunday evening or Monday. I think I left on a Monday. On Tuesday, it started to rain. And it was October when I was there, I think. And it kept raining. And it kept raining. And it kept raining. And it rained for 4 months. They had to close the schools because there was so much rain, there was terrible flooding. But literally, my half-brother lives there, and he called me. He said, what did you do? He says, my kids can't go to school because it's raining, and it's been raining for like months now. Like, what, you know, I said, I don't have any prayers to make it stop. But it was literally all the way into January. It didn't stop raining. You know, God's mercy. So, yes, in the back.
Can you tell us a little bit about the history of the icon and what the purpose for the jewelry that's on it?
All the jewelry is gifts from people that have been healed from chronic ailments and or have had children from St. Anna's intercessions. So she's got a big pile of it at home. I don't let her wear it all because it's just too much. And even this, I'm thinking about moving the pearls because I'm just getting a little tired of them, you know. But you know, she's got a lot, you know. And I've even tried to kind of, you know, get rid of some of it because it's just too much, you know what I mean? Like, what am I going to do with it, you know? She can only wear so much. But each one is from somebody who had something from St. Anna, some help from St. Anna. But even these hands, especially, these hands are from two people who couldn't have children. This is their first baby, that's their second baby. The inscription is on the hands of the child's initials on each of the hands. So, you know, she does a lot of work. She helps a lot of people. So, and there's always, you know, Father Athanasio always used to say, he said, this icon's alive. And I believe it. I mean, that he was the original caretaker of the icon. And it really does have a presence which is palpable and profound. So, any other questions before we get back? Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Father. I made myself a bunch of enemies. It's on? I made myself a bunch of enemies one day. Uh-huh. And there were like four of them. And all I did was, I mean, I said something sarcastic. Oh, my. Oops. And that animosity didn't go up. 2 years later, we're still cold-shouldering one another. Mm. And I didn't have any animosity toward them, not that I know of. But they were hissing behind my back and stuff like that. And it took a toll. Mm. It took a toll. They were really mean to me. Mm. And, well, I don't know, the first year I just sort of said, oh, it'll go away. It'll go away. Mm-hmm. No, it didn't. And I kept being normal, you know, just doing things the normal way and letting it go. Mm. No, that didn't work. And finally, just after sort of almost at the end of the second year, I said to myself, wait a minute, I could pray for them, couldn't I? Mm. And that did it. It was about a month of prayer, but I would pray that they be healed from their animosity, that they forgive me for what in fact, I used to agree with them. You know, yeah, I agree, I did that. Yeah, oh yeah, I did that. Yeah. You know, like, but that really, praying for them, and I've been trying to learn how to pray for my enemies, and I mean, sort of ever since then. So, when you pray for your enemies, if you pray for their healing,
yeah,
what else can you do?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, it's important to remember, I think that Christ asks us to pray for our enemies, not only because does it it helps them, but it also helps us as well. It provides us kind of a shield against the negativity and against the unpleasantness of the other, which sometimes can be profound. But also, as I mentioned last night or this morning, by thinking evil, we become evil. So we don't want to think evil of people that have done evil to us so that we ourselves are not infected with that, you know. There's a St. Silouan has a saying that if our neighbor is our enemy, the devil's our friend. You know, if other people are our enemies in the sense of, like, we see them as enemies, it's really the devil who's behind it. Nobody's our enemy. Nobody's our enemy. Even Saint Nikolai said, Lord, I don't have enemies, only cruel friends. you know? So his perspective of, like, he has this whole poem in one of his prayers by the lake, says, "Bless my enemies, O Lord." One of the fathers at home, you know, he has a funny saying. He says, "Love your enemies because you made them." You know, it kind of puts it in the right perspective. It's a little bit more on the ground, mundane, but it's kind of like we have to keep it in our court, the ball in our court. When I start to pray for other people, then I can see what my part was. Until I begin praying for you, I can't really see my own part. It's too much of an intermix, you know, what I did wrong or what I was contributing to the situation. But there's never a time in our life where being the first to ask for forgiveness would be a bad idea. Very rarely, I say like one in a million. Because oftentimes we make other people through our actions, whether known or unknown or inadvertently or whatever, lose their peace and even their communion with God. So if we are in a bad state and we cause other people to be in a bad state and they've broken their communion with God because they're mad at us, that's what I apologize for, even if it's not necessarily my fault. Do you know what I mean? Like if I wasn't the progenitor of the whole problem exactly, I still ask for forgiveness for my part, whatever that was. And ultimately their loss of peace and their loss of their communion with God, which I somehow precipitated. It's funny because St. Tikhon of Zadonsk, our patron, there's a very famous story about him. And it was said that there was a man who was very against the church and very upset, and he went to see St. Tikhon of Zadonsk and was speaking to him very rudely and was saying about how the Orthodox Church was this and the Orthodox Church was that and Christianity was this and how bad it was with that and all these kind of terrible things. And St. Tikhon got a little bit mad at him. He was upset. And, of course, the guy was wrong, but him being upset about it, you know, was his part. And then it led the guy to kind of, I think, give him a bit of, he got really upset and gave him a slap, I think, something like that. The guy slapped St. Tikhon. And in that moment, St. Tikhon of Zadonsk said, he just made a prostration on the ground. He said, "Forgive me, I'm so sorry for making you do that, for causing you to get so upset that you would actually do that." And it was in that moment that the guy actually converted and became like a very incredibly faithful Orthodox Christian. Because of that, like, Christ-like movement, that changed the heart of that other guy. It wasn't because he fought him with strength and power and might. It was through his absolute humility and complete self-emptying that he won the other person over. That Christ-likeness, I mean, there's a Desert Father story like that that says one of these monks was at the market, and the fellow was coming to buy the baskets from the monks because they were in, you know, like the desert, you know, 5th century, 6th century. And the one shop owner who kept coming to buy the baskets, he had a daughter who was very sick and demon-possessed. So he kept coming to buy these baskets from this monk, and he said, "You have to come to my house because my daughter's very sick and you need to pray for her." And he said, no, I can't do that. I'm just a monk. What am I going to be able to do for your daughter, you know?" And he said, "No, you must. He kept buying baskets. And so finally he bought so many baskets, he said, "I don't have enough money with me, but I'm buying all of your baskets. Please come to my house and I'll give you the money." So the monk said, "Fine." So off they go to his house. The daughter opens the door. The monk is at the door. And the door opens, and there's the monk just kind of, you know, like a deer in the headlights. And the daughter just winds up and just punches him right in the face. You know, the demon-possessed daughter. And then so the monk just looks, and he just turns the other cheek like this and gives her the other side. And in that moment, the daughter falls down on the ground, and the demon leaves her. And it is the power of just keeping the commandments that, like, liberates kind of that tyranny of the passions, which is actually afflicting other people. By us kind of being more responsive and more prayerful, a lot of the times we help the other person as well. So it's a profound thing, you know, but just keeping those commandments. Only God could ask us to love our enemies. I think that that's, you know, and St. Silouan says this, like, that's how we know that Orthodox Christianity just in general, is true and from God, because only God, no other religion asks anybody to do that, and only God could help us to do that, because that's the way that God is, and that's how God lives himself. So that Christ-likeness that we actualize through the process of keeping the commandments, especially love for enemies, St. Sophronius says that love of enemies is actually the uncreated fire of God that Christ came to kindle on the earth. So when we just make a little movement in that direction and say a prayer for those people, it doesn't justify their actions. We're not talking about calling evil good or being okay, but it's just the commandment of God. We're just doing what Christ says. Bless, do good, and pray for all those who are around you, but especially your enemies. Bless them, do good for them, and pray for them. Why? Because in doing so, we preserve ourselves and we help them. And we also somehow become bearers of that light which is in the world to come today. Just through that simple thing.
One would be, so you've been talking a lot about how to love our enemies, but I think there are some circumstances where it would might be a good idea to stand up to people too. Like, when do you discern between when to turn the other cheek and when to stand up for, when standing up would be a better thing to do?
Yeah, it doesn't in any way, shape, or form negate our responsibility and or our, it's not about like a lack of strength or not standing up to people. It's always about our disposition. Can I do something in the right spirit? If I'm going to stand up to somebody, I have to be incredibly strong and of sound mind myself, not reacting at all. Because like it says in the scriptures, the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God. I'm not by my own kind of small self-will going to kind of change the world. There is a time it's better to kind of be on the defense than the offense. So, it depends. Like if somebody's, trying to attack you or your family, that's one thing, in the sense of verbally or even physically. But it's always a defensive posture, we don't go out swinging, as it were, because it never really works in our favor, and it always puts us in a place of danger. So it depends on the situation, number one, what context we're talking about, because there are so many that we could say, but being more on the defensive side rather than the offensive side is always an important thing, and being able to do it in the right spirit. Not being bitter, not being angry, not being vindictive or mean-spirited about it. But we can calmly say, if somebody's making fun of our Orthodox faith, we can calmly say, this is what I believe, and that's it. I'm not going to, I believe that this is true and right, and no matter what you say to me, it's not going to change that or what I feel, believe, or what I'm going to do. We have to kind of stand strong, as it were. But it doesn't mean that we kind of lash out. It's a very subtle thing, and each situation is different. But I'm not going to back down from somebody myself. But it just depends on the situation, how dangerous it is. Will it cause more of a problem? Here's an example. Reminds me of two things. We had this high-ranking visitor at the monastery several years ago that came. He was visiting from another country. He's a very high-ranking dignitary. And I had some of my security around the monastery security, on alert and so forth, because it's a pretty, pretty big deal. But there's some guy out in the parking lot with a picket sign. And as soon as this person pulls up, he starts, he has his picket sign, and he's going, la, 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 kind of yelling and spewing and kind of going crazy, a very volatile kind of looking situation. I was wondering, he looked kind of, not well mentally. So I thought to myself, what's the best way to handle this one, If I go up there and confront him and I say, you got to leave, and, if I start being strong, as it were, I might create more of a problem than solve it. So what I did was, instead of seeing a problem, I saw a person, and I went just right up to the person. And the guy, you could tell he was a little unnerved because, you know, he either wanted to fight or kind of, you know, do his thing. And I just went right up to him, and I said, good morning. How are you today? What is this that you're doing, and what do you need here? So I treated him like a person. I tried to give him respect and honor and just some basic dignity, being made in the image of God, being, you know, a person who might be struggling or whatever. I gave him a little bit of space, and I approached him in a way that gave him an opportunity to respond to me. And what ended up happening was he kind of was relatively cordial, not that crazy kind of picket carrying sign guy who was yelling just a minute ago. He kind of calmed down, and I just asked him, I said, well, you know, I didn't want to create again more of a problem. I said, why don't you just go down to the other parking lot and do your thing so you're away from the church and we can continue what we're doing up here. And he did. But it just, you know, there has to be, you know, it reminds me of another Desert Father story where there's this pagan priest who's, you know, St. Macarius and his disciples are on their way to a vigil. And St. Macarius sends his disciples ahead to prepare for the vigil. And as they're on their way to the vigil, they see a pagan priest on the side of the road who's, you know, doing some crazy things. And they get in an altercation with him, and they get in like a fist fight with the pagan priest, and they all kind of start duking it out. And the disciples end up going and, you know, on their way to get ready for the vigil to worship God after they've had this fist fight. And St. Macarius comes along about an hour later, and he sees this fellow along the side of the road who's been kind of visibly, you know, disheveled and very disturbed. And he says, oh, St. Macarius, good man of God, what happened to you? Let me take care of you. How are you doing? What's the problem here? Let me sit down here. Calm down. He grabs his hand and he holds his hand. What happened? You know, he treats him very, very well. And very kind and very honored and very dignified in a way that's just like caring and like, you know, acknowledging this person and his pain. And he said, oh, the pagan priest says, these people came by and they started yelling at me, and then we got in a fist fight, and I couldn't believe that they were, and then, you know, and I was, oh, I'm so sorry, you know. And so this guy eventually became one of St. Macarius' disciples. But it just shows it's our approach that kind of will determine, you know, and that's why discernment is necessary. You can't always, sometimes it's just better to leave a situation completely, not even enter into it, you know. There's certain things that I won't even touch because I know it's just too volatile and it's too dangerous. So it depends. But we can always bless, we can always do good, and we can always pray for somebody. Do this from a distance or a little bit up more up close, but just knowing that I can't from a reactive place bring about a good result. I myself, when I go in and I start guns blazing, you know, like so often in the monastery, somebody says, oh, do you know what Father so-and-so did? Father so-and-so was over there and there's these people and blah, 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 blah. And so Father so-and-so, and I'm like, and so if I take that at face value, I say, oh my gosh, Father so-and-so, I can't believe he went in it. So I'm going to go find Father so-and-so, and I'm going to say, Father so-and-so, why did you do this? If I do that, I've already lost. You know what I mean? Every situation is different, but I listened to what they said. Mm-hmm, okay, uh-huh, yeah, uh-huh, okay. All right, thank you. I'll look into that, thank you. And then I go to Father so-and-so, and I say, hello, Father so-and-so, how are you today? Good, Father, I'm fine. Tell me, was there something that happened earlier with such and such and this and that in place? And then I hear the other side of the story, which is, again, something so different and something so, you know, it's this other world, and there's all these facets to every single problem. So if I would have gone in there guns blazing, I would have already ruined the situation and created more of a problem than there was to begin with. It's not going to help us solve a problem. So my trying to be non-reactive and trying to recognize this person, then have them be responsive to me and help me to understand exactly what's going on, that's where I start from, and then I analyze what I'm going to do about the problem. So, did that help a little bit, or do you have something more detailed that you're thinking of?
What would be a situation where you might, like, have to speak up and, like, stand up and, like, kind of be firm? Like,
Father Zacharias has a good thing about that. He says, be kind but firm. You're never going to go wrong if you're kind and firm. It's like, this is the way it is. This is what's going to happen, or this is how I feel, or this is, you know, it's not about being wishy-washy or backing down. We do need to kind of at a basic level, validate ourselves, but not all the time. Not all the time, you know? So rarely do I need to do it, but once in a while I do. It's like, look, you hurt me. This is, you know, you said this. It was very difficult for me. I don't like that. Please don't do that again. Do you know what I mean? Like, but I don't need to do that very often. You know, most of the time I just let it go because most stuff doesn't matter, you know? A lot of it's very small stuff in the scope of things. I marvel just at how much of our life we're going to forget. And that's why it's so important to try to be present today and to have a life of prayer and to be close to the church and to be, like, engaged, you know. I was thinking about this just as we were starting, the whole concept of in the church, because Christ is the Word of God, and Christ reveals to us the Father through his word, and even Christ says, the word that you gave me, I've given them. That idea of a sacramental word is so strong in the mind of the church. And a sacramental word is where something sticks out, like let's say on a Sunday morning, like you've been going, like let's say you had a big fight with your spouse or something like that, and then you go to church, and the gospel that morning is like about how to forgive people. You know, that's a sacramental word. God's like, hello, I saw it. I'm not happy. So we're giving you this reading. You know, that's a sacramental word. It's a little bit more kind of obvious, but there are so many times that God is giving us a word if we are trying to listen. A word can come from anybody. It can come from anything. If we are present, paying attention, watchful, and prayerful, when we do our daily readings, so oftentimes we'll find a little gem in there. That's like, oh, that word gives me some inspiration. That word gives me some context. That word gives me a little bit of a check on the compass of my heart to just slightly reorient me in the right direction. So often when we're reading the gospel every day, we'll get that. So often, like when we are engaged in patristic, just a little bit of patristic reading, like from St. Silwan, it'll be just what we need. So often, if we live in that place, God will always be trying to speak to us through the daily circumstances of our life if we are present and paying attention and expecting and knowing that that's how God works, through the sacramental word. Why? Because Christ is the Word of God. And that word that he speaks to us is spirit and it's life, and it vivifies our soul. So a lot of times that people come to a monastery and say, Father, give me a word. In that context, you know, they don't usually come doing that for me, but I remember like at the monastery in Essex, when I go there, Father Zacharias, you know, they say, the younger monk will come up to him and say, Father, give me a word for the feast. And then he'll say, blah, 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 blah. And that will be the word, you know. And even when he came last time to the monastery, which is probably the last time he'll come to America, he was just there for Memorial Day. He really is a shining light and a supreme example of Christian, like, authentic life, spirit, and living. But I remember we were in the altar, and he knew that, you know, I wouldn't ask, but he was kind of trying to give me these little words, you know. And one of the things that he told me when we were serving liturgy together, I took the chalice from the bishop. You know how the priest comes and he says, always, now, and ever, and unto ages of ages. He has the chalice, you know, and it's after communion has happened. The priest says, oh God, save thy people, bless thine inheritance. And then he says, always, now, and ever, to ages of ages. He takes the chalice over to the table of oblation. You know, he told me in that moment, he's like, look, he says, remember always at that moment, he says, this is an eternal event. They're holding up the chalice and they're trying to tell you and remind you every single liturgy that this is always, now and forever, this communion with God. And I just, you know, those kind of like little things like that are offered to us, whether by a holy elder or even by a little child. So often God will be trying to kind of witness to us and vivify us through these little things. So be on the watch for those things in your own personal reading. Again, like I said, having a consistent prayer rule is the most important thing that I can tell you. There's an outer part of prayer and there's an inner part of prayer, and that inner part of prayer has no depth. It is profoundly depthless. There is no depth to it. It keeps going deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and growing and becoming more of a phenomenon and more of a mystery and more of a of something that we enter into again and again and again. And it changes us. It changes our life. And that small prayer rule that I gave you, it could expand to something much larger of 20, 25 minutes, a half an hour, 45 minutes of the Jesus Prayer, and some more prayers, reading an Akathist, reading the gospel, reading spiritual reading. All that stuff can continue to kind of expand and grow as you grow and expand as well. But it's the essential part. And that perspective of be still and know is the essential way that we approach it, with that attitude of listening, of attentive watchfulness. They call it the Neptic tradition because it's the watchful tradition. Christ goes to the cross. The last two words that he says, or three words that he gives to the disciples, what are they? Right before he goes to the cross, the last thing he says, three words. No. That was way before. No, well, that's on the cross. But these are the last thing he says to the disciples before he goes. The kind of last instructions. Watch and pray. That's it. Watch and pray. So the last thing he really tells everybody is like the last instructions, right? Watch and pray. This is, you know, those words are eternal that Christ speaks. It's not just for that moment. It's forever. Watch and pray. He says that because we're all kind of going to the cross in some ways. We all will pass from this life. We'll all have sickness. We'll all have death. What is the instruction to us as we are going to the cross in our own lives, whether it's through our daily afflictions or through the difficulties that we might encounter in the future? Watch and pray. Watch and pray. Be present. Pay attention. Listen. Do it in such a way, this watchful tradition, this Neptic tradition, is so profound. It's so deep. There's an inner part that just continues to go deeper, deeper, deeper. Let me just read you one quote from St. Macarius that talks about what the heart is. Because remember, that word that I said that kind of defines orthodoxy is person. Person is mystery. Person is ultimately something that's only fulfilled in God. Our personhood is fulfilled in the person of Christ. Me being in communion with him actualizes and activates my personhood. The grace that comes from God activates my own kind of capacity and my own, what's the word I'm looking for? My own potential. It's only in his light that we see light. It's only in his person that we find our person. Without him, we can do nothing. But the center of that person is the heart. Center of the heart is the noose. The noose is the attention. It's the most simple way I can tell you, like, what to say, what is the noose? It's like, noose is your attention. Wherever your attention is that's where your mind is. If you put your attention in your heart, your mind is in your heart. And when you speak to God from that place, you are a complete and a whole person trying to speak to God. It won't stay like that, though. It has to keep kind of coming back. We keep trying to do this, that round peg into the square hole. We just keep trying to put it back in there. And then somehow, by God's grace, oftentimes with a little bit of blood, sweat, and tears, that's when the transformation and the union of the heart and the mind can actually happen. And that's what a saint is. They've come back together, and their heart and their mind have become one, and it's the grace of God that's kind of glued it together. So if the center of the mystery of person is the heart, St. Macarius tells us a little bit about what the heart is, because as I mentioned, we are kind of this great and kind of unfathomable mystery, just we ourselves, you and me. We don't even really know ourselves, you know? Only through great difficulty do we come to a little bit of self-knowledge, and even then it's kind of like we get so sleepy so quick, you know? Life is very difficult. I'm the first one to admit that that's a phenomenon with me. He says this. He says, the heart governs and reigns over the whole bodily organism. But when grace possesses the heart, it rules over all of the bodily members and even the thoughts. Within the heart are unfathomable depths, your heart. In your heart there are reception rooms and bedchambers, doors and porches, many offices and passages. In your heart is the workshop of righteousness and of wickedness. In the heart is death, and in the heart is life. Your heart is Christ's palace, and there Christ the King comes to take his rest with the angels and the spirits of the saints. Christ dwells there. He walks within it and places his kingdom there. The heart is but a small vessel, and yet dragons and lions live there. Poisonous creatures and all the treasuries of wickedness. Rough, uneven paths are there and gaping chasms. But there likewise is God. There are the angels. Their life and the kingdom. Their light and the apostles. The heavenly cities and all the treasuries of grace. Because all things are in your heart. There's a lot down there. Obviously, right? I mean, but the task for all of us is just to enter again into that work. I mean, we're not going to reach the level of St. Macarius, and we don't have to. The miracle of the church is that this inheritance that we have in the saints, in the liturgy, in the theological kind of worldview of the church, the whole entirety of it, the purpose of the liturgy is what the liturgy really is it's perfect prayer. It's perfect prayer. It's prayer on behalf of all and for all. It's prayer for the entire world and universe. And literally, the fathers say that the energy and the prayer of the church, it keeps the world together. Like prayer, there's always this thought in ancient Judaism that the prayer of seven righteous men upheld the entire world, like kept it together. And there's that same thought in St. Silouan and the fathers. It says that when real prayer ceases, then the end of the world will come, because the world is preserved by the prayer of these saints. That prayer, though, is really epitomized, and the epicenter of it is in the liturgy. That perfect prayer, perfect hypostatic prayer, that's what it's called. It's like this prayer for everything and for everyone at all times and all seasons, both living and departed. It's universal. It encompasses all time and space. This perfect prayer of the liturgy is our inheritance. All we have to do is have that tiny bit of consistency in our own prayer role that opens up the aperture of the heart enough to let it in, so that that perfect prayer becomes our inheritance. There's an opening for it to go in, and it becomes ours by default. It's like a sleeper's progress. All we have to do is open up that little spot in the heart to let that light and that life in. The more that we prepare for the liturgy, the more we'll receive at the liturgy. So it's a tremendous inheritance. It's a tremendous blessing. It's all here. All we have to do is just have an opening. And I always think to myself, you know, you could kind of qualify spiritual life down into four words. And to some degree, spiritual life and salvation is just, it's either a yes or a no. Is it yes to God? Is it yes to my life? Is it yes to the people in my life? Especially when they ask me to do things and I'm kind of upset about it, or I have to do stuff I don't want to do, or I got to go to church again or whatever. All that stuff. Is it a yes to God and to those in my life? Or is it a no to God and a no to those in my life? It's very simple at the end of the day. A yes to God is salvation. And so often, difficult stuff will come in our lives, and we'll have to give that yes. Maybe a cancer, maybe a loss of a job, maybe a loss of a spouse. How to say yes. Not fight, you know. Part of spiritual life is not about fighting. It's about learning to surrender and let go and just let God be God and me be his creature and his servant. But those four words that I would, kind of like, if you could always have these ready at hand, this is kind of like the sleeper's progress for spiritual life. The first one is being able to say okay. People come up and say, oh, can you help after church? It's like, okay. Can we go to that extra service tonight, mom or dad? Okay. Are you ready to go to communion? Okay. Let's go to confession? Okay. That okay, it's just a very simple thing that we can do when we're dealing with other people, when we're dealing with ourselves, and when we're dealing with God. Okay. Second one, thank you. should always be on our mouth or close to it, especially to other people. People really like to be able, you know, when people say, do something for us, it's good to acknowledge them. Thank you so much. Very important to be thankful and kind and all of those good things like Christians should be. Thank you is something that we could never really say enough, especially to God. And St. Sophroni says that, St. Bessarion says that thanksgiving to God intercedes for our weaknesses and makes up for our shortcomings. So we may be, you know, having a really tough time being a Christian, but if we were thankful, God would still be with us, and God would still help us, and in the end, everything would be okay. Why? Because we had that good disposition. Third word is forgive me. Should always be ready on our mouth to be able to just say, forgive me. You know, whatever it is. Even if, you know, I remember Father Hilary, we had a little bit of a problem. Oh my goodness. Really? Must be the devil. Sorry, I'm just kidding. There it is. Uh-oh. Hey, let me see here. Swipe up to answer. There you go. Swipe down to send them back. It's okay. It's kind of fun. Yeah, how did it get the ringer off, right? Hey, let me see. Let's see here. I think it's off now. Yeah. I think it's off now. We've had fun, haven't we? There we go. We're good. So, Father Hilary, you know, he was having a hard time one day, and it was towards the end of his life, one of the monks that I had to take care of in the monastery. And he was very upset at me, and I was just trying to get him to take his medicine. And the nurse said, get him to take this medicine when he's feeling like this. He wouldn't do it, and we got in real kind of explosive. He was upset at me, and I was upset at him. So I left, and I went outside over by the bell tower, and I was very upset. And I just remember thinking to myself, well, if I don't go back in to help him, who's going to help him? Because really, there's nobody else in the monastery. This was years ago. Nobody young enough to kind of deal with it. And so I went back in, and I said, forgive me. It's my fault. We'll just not worry about that medicine and let me go get you your, you know, lunch or whatever. And he looked at me, and I never forget what he said. He said, if you can ask for forgiveness even when it's not your fault, there will always be hope for you. Yeah, it's in my book. And I just never forgot it. It's like that ability to ask for forgiveness even when it's not our fault, it means we have a tiny bit of humility. And in that moment, God, I'm certain, you know, will always be with us. Why? Because we're blessed are the peacemakers because they shall be called the sons of God. And then the fourth word was a rather advanced word. I only recommend using it if you're in an advanced level of functioning. It's the word whatever. It's very advanced. It has to be positive. It can't be negative. It can't be flippant. It's just like, whatever. Okay, whatever. You just let it go, you know? It has to be done the right way, though, so that's an advanced one. I won't, you know, push that one on you. Yes? Yes.
The word whatever has been an important word for helping me when I'm upset about something or and Satan's putting a lot of negative thoughts in my mind about what's happening to me and I'm getting so focused on myself that when I say to myself, whatever, it totally diffuses the problem because you realize it is not a big deal what's happening to you.
Right.
When you start saying, well, whatever, so what? Yeah. So this happens, so what? And you keep going down there.
You say it to yourself, and that's like the best way to use that word.
Best for me.
You don't usually normally say it to, but a lot of times I'll just say, people say, oh, I want to do this, then. I was like, okay, whatever. Like, it's fine with me. Like, you know, that way I don't have to get too involved in other people's difficulties or, you know, kind of figuring things out. Like, especially, like you said, on the inside, it really does work to just help to just kind of let go of stuff. So it's very advanced, though. You have to use it very carefully.
Phone ring. first time.
What's that?
Can you recollect what you were going to say? When the phone rang the first time, about, was it what you were saying? I think it's about Christ. But the first time?
Hmm. The phone ringing. I can't remember, to be honest with you. I apologize. But.
Can't recollect?
I can't. Yeah. I'm sorry. Sorry. Other question in the back there? Run. Just kidding. You don't have to do that. Hold on. Oh. I can't remember. Yeah. Yeah, I always get in the middle of something. I might come back to it, though, just by default.
We're not going to listen to anything. Okay. I'll leave it.
Oh, yeah. No, that was a while ago. I can't remember. Yeah. And now I can't even remember anymore. I'm sorry. I don't know. Your question, sorry. We might come back to it.
What is the role of silence and stillness in the spiritual life, especially in this age of overstimulation where we have smartphones and internet and computer and the radio and television, all these things? What role does silence and stillness play? Because this is all new. I mean, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, like our ancestors didn't have all these distractions and all these things that are constantly interrupting us and breaking our concentration,
right.
To the point where you can't even, pray for a long time and be focused and concentrated.
Yeah, I think, though, it gets back to what we were talking about earlier about, I mean, silence and stillness are the essential core. It's called hesychasm. Be still and know, right? This is the way to the knowledge of God. So how to create some space for that to happen in my life is really the question. And so it has to be a calculated move on my part to be able to say every morning at 7 o'clock, because that's when I'm the most capable and when I wake up and I have enough time, I'm going to do my prayer rule for 20 minutes, no matter what. But I think, though, it gets back to what we were saying earlier, but we can't say, well, just because I have some distractions means that I can't do it. Sometimes we have to allow for the distractions because it's the only way we can get it done. You know what I mean? We don't have an either-or situation where we're in the desert or something like that. But we try to minimize the distractions as far as we're able to, put our phone on silence or whatever. But it doesn't mean that there won't ever be any distractions. And sometimes we can just pray through them and allow, again, some time in our prayer where we're not always constantly having to do something. It's more of an attitude of kind of receptivity and openness rather than, and receiving rather than kind of proactively trying to kind of reach out to God and say, where are you, God? It's more like we realize God's already here. I just need to open up to that fact and receive kind of what he has and has given already. I need to discover what's there. And so allowing for that pause is really important in between the Jesus prayer, in between other prayers that I do, and even in between when I'm reading something, I don't just kind of read through it just to get it done. I'm in there and I'm kind of squeezing each word and I'm allowing some space in between the sentences and I'm not just hurrying through just to get something done, but I'm allowing for this time where I can just kind of be. And in that, I'm trying to pray, but I'm not trying to get something done. And that's why I would say it's better to try to have a set amount of time rather than a set amount of prayers that you do. Because if I just have all these prayers, like, well, I have to do my prayer rule, and so I got to get all through all these prayers, it's very counterproductive to stillness. And so whatever you can do in that realm, I think the time is the key. Set amount of time. Nearly the same time every day. But I don't think that you should kind of have an either-or mentality to it. Just try to limit the distractions, but if they come, it's just kind of, you just have to work through them. Whether it's in thought or it's in the phone or whatever it might be, the main work of prayer is just coming back to the prayer itself. It's not about like abiding in prayer and somehow arriving at prayer. It's a constant return to prayer. That it's like because of the fall, we can't really keep ourselves in check for very long. So it's a constant return. Constant return to self, unto God. Constant return to self, unto God. I'm just constantly returning to myself and to prayer. This is kind of like, it's not quite the cyclical movement that St. Gregory Palamas talks about, but it really is what I would consider cyclical prayer, a constant return back to self, unto God. It's just this, that's all I'm doing when I'm praying. I'm not arriving somewhere in prayer. I'm just returning to prayer over and over and over and over again. The entire time I'm praying. And then sometimes after I prayed for a long enough time, when it gets to be a certain amount of time, then my attention starts to crystallize and something happens where grace starts to be active. And I can tell you that if you consistently do a life of prayer for like maybe like 40 to 50 to 60 minutes a day, there is a point where we become sensitive to grace. And we actually can sense God's presence in our hearts and in our lives in a way that's oftentimes very tangible, but it's not an end point even then. It's not even a, it's just a beginning. But I think that allowing for enough time for us to kind of come to ourselves and then to God, it's just that giving ourselves that space, it happens by itself. It's not something that I do. It's something that I allow for and like have enough space and time and allow God to do in me. It's me coming to myself, and it's almost like it just takes a long time for that to happen. But there is a point where we can get to in prayer where if we're consistent and we have enough time in, where the heart starts to open and we become sensitive to the divine spiritual sensation and we learn to live by it. It's not a high place. But it's so necessary for us to know that it's the experience of God that's not only we're capable of having. It's important to know that we can experience God, that we can know God, and that this knowledge is our salvation, and it's just something for all of us. It's not like, oh, just the monks are hesychasts. It's like, no, we all need silence. We all need to pray the Jesus prayer. We all need that. It's not just for, you know, it's for everybody. Hesychasm for everyone. I want to write a book, Hesychasm for Dummies, but I don't think it would go over very well. But I'm kind of like that. Every time I go to pray like that, my brain is always like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? What's going on? Why are you trying to do this? And I say, shh, shh. But what are you doing? Why are you trying to be quiet right now? I say, shh. Because the head likes to just know about things and wonders, and it's always wandering around and kind of making noise and causing problems. I just say, shh, trying to pray. You know, because there is this interior monologue that will take over sometimes, and that's what the Jesus prayer tries to table. That's the reactive part, really. Well, why did they say that to me? I can't believe they said that. Can you believe they said that? Blah, 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 blah. Well, what are we going to do tomorrow about that? It's like, well, I'm going to go to that person. I'm going to tell them what I really think about them. Right? The brain goes like that. It's called monologue. It's an interior kind of dialogue with the passions, which is actually monologistic and kind of satanic. And it can kill us. It can make us crazy. So the task for all of us is to stop that monologue, to start saying the Jesus prayer, and begin using that as a tool to dialogue with God. It's a very simple way. I know it's so simplistic, the Jesus prayer, but it's the easiest way to begin a dialogue with God. We're heartfelt. If we're attentive, if we can kind of like do it in the right way, it's the easiest way to dialogue. It's so simple, but it works. It's not an end point, but it's just a tool and a beginning. Question.
Do you have any advice on how to overcome power?
That's funny because St. John Climacus has a great quote about that. Oh, where's the microphone? No, but the microphone is needed. But it's because it's being recorded, and so when you don't, you know.
Do you have any advice on how to overcome cowardice?
Yeah, so the principal part of cowardice, believe it or not, is vainglory. Somehow vainglory is like deeply like involved in cowardice. Why, I'm not exactly sure, but I know that they are related. So the more that we kind of give into like vainglorious thoughts, and you know, like St. John Climacus says, you know, St. John Climacus is the author of the Ladder. We commemorate him every fourth Sunday in Lent. He's just a magnificent writer. The book is this Mount Everest of spiritual experience and life. If you approach a book like that, you know, this book right here, you know, we're talking about more easy things to read that are in the same vein, same thought process, but a little bit more contemporary and easy. This is a great book, The Art of Prayer by St. Theophon. It's a great book. It's a wonderful book. You have it in the bookstore. St. John Climacus is a much more kind of imposing and daunting kind of read. However, if you approach this book, and of course these have like, this is considered like a chapter, just this one paragraph, that would be considered a chapter in a patristic context. Just reading like that for one day is plenty. If you read something like St. John Climacus, a little bit of day is fine. But just know that, like, as a monastic, if I can just find one thing, because we read that every year in the dining hall during Lent. We only have one meal a day, so that's just the main reading that we get. If I could just get one thing out of that book every year, perfect. You know, that's the way you do patristic writing. It's not all for us. It's not all for where we're at right now. It's too comprehensive of a book to say that I need to follow everything in it at any given time, because I'm not there. And some of it might be kind of scary in that regard. But the reason why I bring that up is because he has an interesting quote. He says, flog your enemies with the name of Jesus when you feel cowardice. But that vainglory, he says, beams on all activities. And so it's something that, if we're talking about thoughts the other day, and the thought of vainglory is something that we need to repent of immediately before God. So we have a vainglorious thought, oh, how wonderful I am for giving this talk, and all these people are being benefited, blah, blah, blah. Like, I know it's not true, right? Because somebody's back there going, that guy's crazy. But in that moment, if I have that thought, which I don't have it right now, okay, you have to say, oh, God, forgive me. Like, we have to repent immediately. Otherwise, we set in motion certain kind of forces that will eventually boomerang and come back to us and bite us. One of them that will happen is if I give into that thought, they say, oh, how great I am and blah, 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 it'll come back around and eventually I'll have some despair. I'm not that good. I'm a terrible person. Oh, there's no hope for me, et cetera, et cetera. But it was because I gave into that other thought. There's always this give and take with this stuff, where if you set in motion one part of these passionate thoughts or whatever, another one comes around, and sometimes they say that also, too, like, if you give into the thought of vainglory, sometimes it's the Trojan horse of lust. So there's a connection of, like, a web with all of these things. Some thoughts, though, like, let's say we were talking about judgmental thoughts the other day. The easiest way to rout a judgmental thought is not to fight it, because, like I said, it's not in our capacity to not have the thoughts, and it's in our capacity to either accept or reject them. With judgmental thoughts, the easiest way to deal with them is to put an addendum on it. So we think, oh, here comes Mr. So-and-so again, and he thinks he's so great and special and blah, 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 blah. And then the addendum comes because I'm watching, I'm present, and I'm paying attention to what's going on in my heart, you know, which is part of the struggle, is to be present. So, oh, Lord, help Mr. So-and-so, and through his prayers, help me. I addend it, you know what I mean? So instead of leaving it, because if I have that judgmental thought, then I start to lose grace, and God starts to pull back from me, and then my life becomes more difficult, and then I start blaming everybody even more. Like Mr. So-and-so, it's his fault, and it's her fault, and you know what I mean? Like, so there's this cause and effect with thoughts, and we don't realize, it's a very subtle matter, but it's very real. But the moment I start judging people is the moment that I start really kind of almost getting close to falling into the same sins myself, because I lose the grace of God, which is keeping me in where I'm at. So, like St. Paul says, in that you judge, you will also be judged. Don't you know, O man, that you do the same things that you're judging other people for? By condemning the defiled, we become defiled. So that judgmental thought always needs to be addended with a prayer for God's mercy for us and for them. Things like lustful thoughts just need to be ignored. The Mother of God is a great person to call upon. Instead of like trying to fight with that thought, you just turn to God immediately and say, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy upon me. Or, oh, Lord, I'm the worst of men. Please help me. Or, Mother of God, please come to my aid. Anger is something where it's just, it's like angry thoughts, you just don't feed them. If you justify anger, it becomes, St. Theophon says, the fire of hell in the heart. So how to deal with an angry thought, you just don't feed it. You let it die out by itself. So we could pray for the other person. We could do whatever we want, but the main thing is not to add to it, because it wants to be justified, anger, right? Anytime we justify anger, it just makes it more solid inside of us, and we become more intractable and irascible and eventually full of rage if we keep feeding it, you know? So we don't justify it. And even St. Theophon says anger is never justified, because we're only hurting ourselves. You know, it's like taking poison and expecting the other guy to die. Ha! I told you. You know? It's crazy. So anyways, dealing with thoughts is really important. Other questions? Yes. Here comes the microphone, man.
Okay. All right. Question about basically prayer rule. I've heard two different thoughts of prayer rules here. One being, if you pray alone, that it actually God can give you grace and speak to you when you're praying alone. Mm. However, the other thought was, if you pray as a couple, the old verse that comes into play is, where two or three are gathered, there I am in the midst. So there's the power of praying as a couple. What is really the right way to do a prayer rule as a married couple?
Both and. I'm always both and. It's just a general principle. Whenever we're looking at, do you do it this way or that way, it's usually both. So it's like, do we do corporate prayer or do we do personal prayer? Both. Should you pray together or should you pray alone? Both. You need both of them. So I know sometimes you might not have time for both, so you have to kind of weigh that and so forth. But really, ideally, you do need a little bit of both.
So when you say both,
Here's the microphone.
So the prayer rule, let's say morning prayer and evening prayer. So
I would say
together alone.
I would say do the one together and then the one alone. You know what I mean?
Oh, so
if you're going to do evening and morning prayers, then just do one together and one of them by yourselves. You know what I mean? Take time to do the Jesus prayer or something by yourself and the other time, you know?
All right.
Now, it comes into another question about the Jesus prayer.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard Elder Ephraim say that if you just say, Lord, have mercy, Lord, have mercy, that's just as powerful as the whole Jesus prayer. Do you know what context that comes into play there, or?
It's the matter of the heart.
Okay.
So is your heart turned to God? It's like any prayer is powerful as long as that inner turning of the heart to the Lord is the first thing that you do. And that's why it's good to not just start blah, 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 to God, but really I have to come to myself, I turn to God, and then I speak. There's some preparation there before as we understand like the mechanics of prayer, like how to best do it, how it becomes most efficacious. Like, it's essential for me to, like, be present and aware enough to be like, oh, I have to come back to myself. I need to turn my heart to God, and then I need to speak, Lord, have mercy. That's a powerful prayer. It doesn't matter what it is in that moment. But really, it's almost like having a cell phone, and here's my phone, right? And it's like, I'm not going to dial the phone number to the bishop, but I'm going to say, hello, Bishop Metropolitan Tikhon, hello. It's not working. Like, I'm not going to get through to him. I need to open up the phone. I need to put in the thing. I need to dial the number, and then I need to wait for it to ring, and then he picks up the phone, maybe, and say, oh, Master, bless. I have to go through some process in order to talk to the bishop. I'm dialing God's phone. How would I not need to kind of do a little bit of preemptive work to facilitate that so it's done in the right way? There is a process. It's not a big one. Very simple, but it's necessary. It's super necessary, ultra necessary, essential, in fact. If my prayer is not going to be vain and or not heard, then there's always a saying, you know, God has three answers to prayers. And none of them are no. Three answers are yes, which is sometimes or not, you know, depending. And always be careful what you pray for as well. You know, you should always, I'm just telling you, we don't always know what we're asking for, and I'll tell you a story if I can remember it in a minute. Sometimes it's yes. Second one is not yet. And the third one is I have something better for you. So that's how God answers prayers. And those are guaranteed kind of, there's no no with God. All the promises of God are yes and in Jesus Christ. So our God is a yes God. It's a positive thing. Even the cross, it's a big plus sign if you didn't notice. I know that's kind of weird, but I realized that one year on the feast, I was like, oh, that makes me happy. Because it's so hard, you know what I mean? But it's positive. It's a good thing. God's working through that. It's just that it's not always that pleasant. But the story is this, and I think poor Josh, he hears all my stories. But I had this one fellow who came to the monastery, and he says to me, he says, Father, he says, if you were to pray for one thing, he said, what would you pray for? He's a very pious man. And I don't usually ask God for anything in specific anymore because I have, you know, I'm fine. I don't really need much. Didn't really think about it. So I said, what would I pray for? It was almost kind of like one of those things where you feel kind of on the spot and almost as if God's listening, you know. So I said, well, I guess I would pray for strength to continue to do what I'm doing. So he says, wonderful. He says, I will pray for you that God grant you strength. And so I had my godfather staying with us at the monastery. And he got very sick. He's 97 years old. He's tonsured a monk. He's been a faithful priest for many, many years. Wife passed away. She came to live with us. And he got very sick. And so I was there taking care of him, and I was trying to transfer him from home health to hospice. And I got caught in this kind of administrative limbo, and I was stuck taking care of him for maybe about 2 or 3 weeks by myself. And he was literally like kind of on death's door. And it was very, very difficult. It was mildly a nightmare. I mean, you were there, right? He was there. Good old Josh. He's the night shift. So I could sleep because it was one of those things where it was like round the clock. And, you know, I was spending 14, 16-hour days with him, or even 18. It's very difficult. So finally, I got him to the nursing home. There were some problems with his daughter, which we couldn't work communicating well, and finally got him to the nursing home. He's fine now. He's very tired and old, but he's relatively okay. But this happened around Lent, believe it or not, just right 2 weeks before Lent and into the first week of Lent. Isn't that timing amazing? It's just perfect. And so his friend came back to see us, and his friend helped me to get him to the nursing home. And then after we were done and all of it was finished, he looked at me and he said, Father, he said, remember, you prayed for strength and now you have it. The only way that I got it, though, was through that terrible, unpleasant, awful, very, very difficult, painful event of having to take care of him and try to figure out the situation. It wasn't through some pleasantries. It was through very difficult stuff. So that's what I'm saying. Be careful what you pray for because you might not know what you're asking for. They always say, you know, don't ever pray for patience. Don't ever pray for humility because you might get opportunities to exercise both of those and it might not be very pleasant. Please know that the monastery always is praying for you. You're always welcome to visit. There are guest houses. The work of the monastery, I think, is one of the most important in the church because everything kind of trickles down from there. If it changes for the good at the monastery, the rest of the church is benefited, and I see that all the time. We have seminarians that we form, so those people become priests, and they go to parishes, and there are a lot of those people. There are pilgrims and friends of the monastery from you know many years, bishops and all sorts of people who have been positively impacted by the mission of the monastery. It really is kind of a central core of the church in America. No matter what jurisdiction you're in, it really is a place where God dwells. It's the dwelling place of God, and it's a very, very powerful place. Sometimes it's difficult to live there because it's so powerful. It's painful. But it's a wonderful place. I believe in it with all of my heart, and I believe that the work that we do there is very important. So your continued prayers, your continued support, your visiting us online or visiting our bookstore, whatever way that you can continue to support the monastery, we greatly appreciate, because I literally give my have given my life's blood to kind of keep it going and get it going in the right direction. And it's been a challenge. And I think it will always be a challenge, but it's because it's so important. And it has a direct impact on everything else that we do in the church. It really does have a profound center to the rest of the church. So be assured of our prayers, and it's so nice to be with you, Father, and to all of you. God bless each and every one of you. If you have more prayer requests, you can always visit us online. And we have Malevins to St. Anna every week. So many good things go on there. So we appreciate your continued prayers, and know that we're praying for you, and glad to be with you today.